Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 39. Today on the show, I have Dr. Ken Clark, researcher, speed coach, and consultant out of Westchester University, Pennsylvania. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the Freelap timing system, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the Speedmat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The Freelap timing system has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. All right. Thank you for tuning in to the episode today. I'm your host, Joel Smith, here on the Just Fly Performance Podcast. We are on episode 39 with Dr. Ken Clark. Ken Clark is a professor of kinesiology at Westchester University of Pennsylvania. He's one of the top experts on speed in the world today, both from a research and a practical perspective. So I say that Ken is, he's not only a researcher, but he also is a coach and does consulting in speed training, working with not only like track and field, linear speed, but also team sports. And so it's just awesome to be able to talk to people who are in the science, but also apply it practically. I've heard Ken on a number of performance podcasts, so I was excited to get him on this one and have him answer a few questions in the world of building speed, both in the context of track and field, as well as team sports. And it's funny, I always had wanted to get Ken on the show, and when I finally did get a hold of him, I started listening to some of these other podcasts he had been on, and it's like every podcast this guy has been on. He is a in-demand speed expert. And you can totally tell by listening to the answers that he has today and his in-depth knowledge of sprinting speed, not only from a, again, not only from a track or a linear or a combine 40-yard perspective, but also from a team sport perspective, and he has the research to back it up. So even if you have listened to some of those podcasts, you'll still like this one. I think the questions are fairly unique, and Ken gives some amazing answers, and I was just really stoked to have him and speaking on a variety of topics. And the ones we're talking about today include things like sprint cues, which to use versus which might not work so well, relationships between top end speed and acceleration, their similarities, how you can use one to coach the other, which I thought was really awesome. I got a lot out of that. We're talking resisted and assisted sprint training using the 1080 team sport, speed concepts like I mentioned, and a lot more. Some of the really unique stuff I think you don't see or hear a lot out there is in the last question when Ken was talking about the way he's applying all this stuff in the scope of team sports, field sports. Just such cool stuff coming from this guy. There's just so many just nuggets in here in terms of getting athletes faster. Such a cool episode with such a just smart, brilliant guy who loves speed training. So with that said, let's get to episode 39 of the Just Fly Performance Podcast with Dr. Ken Clark. All right, Ken, welcome to the show today. Thank you so much for being on here with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be a part of the podcast and just to get a chance to speak with you.
Awesome, man. So could you start it all off by just chatting a little bit about your background in the field and how you got to where you are right now?
Absolutely. So just started out as an athlete, played football and baseball in high school. Then I played NCAA Division III college football. I'm not a very big guy, genetically not very fast, was always just kind of working on my speed, trying to get faster. Have a father who was a high school football coach and a speed coach. We were working on my speed from a very young age. 8 to 10 years old, I remember running 40-yard dashes and really all the way through my college career, just trying to get fast enough to to be a decent running back. After that, I was a graduate assistant football coach at the Division III level. Got to work with some great coaches, including Justice Gallick, who's now the head strength and conditioning coach for the New York Jets. Learned from some other great coaches along the way when I went into the private sector at Summit Sports Training Center in suburban Philadelphia. People like Jesse Wright, who's now with the Philadelphia 76ers. My undergraduate degree was actually in psychology. I decided to go back for a master's degree in kinesiology at Westchester University in suburban Philly. Was mentored there by a guy named Dave Stern, who's now my colleague. He kind of turned me on to the research aspect of things. Did a master's thesis study on resisted sprint training and really liked the research component. Went down to Dallas to do my doctoral training with Dr. Peter Wand in the Southern Methodist University Locomotive Performance Lab. Had a great, also a colleague down there, Dr. Larry Ryan and Andrew Dofa. And then came back up here 2 years ago. I'm a assistant professor in Department of Kinesiology back at Westchester University. And I love what I'm doing. I'm teaching classes in biomechanics, motor learning, and kinetic anatomy. I also coach with various different teams at Westchester University. I'm a volunteer assistant strength and conditioning coach, so I work with track and field and volleyball and women's basketball. And I'm really, really lucky to work with track and field. The head track and field coach is Jason Kilgore, and the sprints coach is Nate Kennedy, and they are just unbelievably progressive guys. We get to sit around and kind of nerd out and talk shop when it comes to sprint mechanics all the time, so that's really great for me. And then I also help out at nearby Haverford College, which is a Division III school. My buddy Corey Waltz is a head strength and conditioning coach, one of the best in the business at the small college level, and I help him with the speed and agility training for some of the field sport athletes there, lacrosse and soccer mostly. So that's kind of what I'm doing right now.
That's awesome, Ken. So it's just great that you can collaborate with some of those head coaches like that. It just makes it so much better in, you know, the total package of speed training and learning and new things. And with some of your research that you've been doing, you've talked about the two mass model of sprinting. So could you elaborate a little bit more on what that entails and maybe some of the practical applications that that might lead towards in, you know, sprint training and speed training?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I went down to Dallas in 2010 to start my doctoral studies with Peter Wand, basically he had a hunch from past data that he'd collected at Harvard and some other universities on top speed sprinting about how the patterns of force application were different in elite sprinters versus not as fast runners, either field sport athletes or just average Joes. So from some of his prior research, he had demonstrated that at top speed, faster runners apply greater vertical ground reaction forces in shorter ground contact times. But it wasn't just that they were applying more force in less time. It was that there was something about the force signature that was different among these the spectrum of runners. Now, we didn't know exactly what it was at the time, but we set out to essentially take 100-plus runners across the spectrum of abilities, from average Joes to field sport athletes to Olympic sprinters, and test them from slow speeds to intermediate speeds to top speeds on the instrumented force treadmill in the locomotor lab there at SMU, and to examine not just how fast they were running, but also how they applied force. Was there this signature force application among faster runners? And what we found really from 2010 to 2014 was that indeed there definitely was this different pattern of applying force that the elites were doing that the average Joes were not. And to put it in pretty simple terms, there was much more force in the first half of ground contact in the elites versus the average Joes. The second half of ground contact was pretty much the same, but the elite sprinters were winding up and punching the ground much harder. They were cocking the hammer and striking the nail much harder than the average runners were. And so this kind of tied in with what we all intuitively know about competitive sprinters. They have the better upright posture, they have the higher knee lift, more aggressive downstroke, and they have a stiffer ground contact. So things that good coaches have been preaching for two decades or more for that matter. But it was kind of neat to, in 2014, publish a paper that said, okay, those are, you know, intuitively with the way we know that these elite sprinters are doing it, but this is what the force signature is resulting. So in 2014, we published a paper that looked at kind of the spring mass model and essentially showed that elite sprinters weren't striking in that type of pattern. They had a much higher rate of force application in the first 300ths of a second of ground contact. Over the next couple of years, we kind of formulated this model that explained, okay, well, it looks like the entire force trace can be just composed of two basic masses. Mass number one, we called it, which was the foot, the ankle, and the lower leg, everything below the knee. And mass number two, which was just everything else above the knee of the ground contact leg. And if you just looked at the accelerations of the lower leg into the ground, i.e., from a practical standpoint, how much the runner is winding up and aggressively striking the ground, the more they accelerate the limb into the ground, the more impact force they're going to get from mass one. And then this kind of rebound from the rest of the body, mass two, that you can accurately predict and model ground reaction forces, vertical forces, for all runners across all speeds. So it wasn't just elite sprinters versus average Joes at top speed. We could accurately model all vertical ground reaction forces, regardless if someone was jogging with a rear foot strike pattern or running at a medium speed with a 4 foot strike pattern, or whether they're sprinting at 26 miles an hour with kind of striking on the ball of the foot the way an elite sprinter does. So that's kind of how the two mass model came about. And that's a broad simplification of it, but I want to keep this answer more applied towards the second part of your question. As far as how it relates to the way in which we may train our athletes or assess sprinting performance, it really tied together, I think, a lot of what was out there in coaching knowledge, some of the things that perhaps Ralph Mann had talked about with posture and front side mechanics and aggressive angular velocity of the leg, kind of what Franz Bosch had talked about with the whip from the hip. And then everything that Peter Wayne had already put out there for two decades or a decade and a half, I guess, with regards to needing more vertical force in a shorter ground contact time. To me, it tied all this together. Okay, we need to have our runner have perfect posture, perfect neutral pelvis, have great front side mechanics. Once they get the thigh positioned in front of them, we need to have them aggressively strike the ground on the ball of the foot. And we need to stay really, really rigid from the foot ground contact all the way up the kinetic chain. So it's the foot, it's, you know, mass one in our model, the foot, the shank, the stance thigh, and then all the way up through the torso, because any energy leak in that kinetic chain is going to lead to a mushy ground contact and less vertical ground reaction forces, which will result in slower sprinting speed, frankly. So just to tie a bow on this question, we need to train for posture, mechanics, and stiffness. That's got to be, of course, the primary emphasis. And, you know, maybe all the good coaches out there will say, well, no kidding, we've been doing that for 20 years. But in some ways, I think it's always good to have science validate or back up, you know, the good intuition that maybe coaches have been practicing. It's good science, in my mind, should either open new doorways for coaching, or it should reinforce what the good coaches have already been doing. And I think this served that purpose.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like there's almost like three offshoots and follow-up questions, so I'll try to organize my thoughts in the best manner I can. But I guess maybe a simplification as well of what you just said would be a negative foot speed. Like, it's almost like your top end speed capability corresponds heavily to the amount of negative foot speed you can generate in that strike down onto the track. Would that be a good way of putting it?
Great question. So with negative foot speed, with the way we looked at it, we looked at essentially how fast the foot and ankle were descending down towards the ground, i.e. what the foot speed was down into the ground. And we did also have kinematic motion analysis measures of how fast the foot was traveling back. And our coordinate system was on a treadmill, so it was back towards the treadmill or the center mass, but you can easily think about it towards the ground in an overground situation. There's no doubt that the faster sprinters had a greater velocity of the foot and lower limb, both down and back into the ground. So absolutely, a big part of the two mass model and a big part of getting greater vertical ground reaction forces was accelerating the limb down and back faster than the average Joes could. The other big part of it, though, was that the elite sprinters could not only accelerate the lower limb down into the ground, they could stop it faster as well. So they could accelerate it down into the ground faster. They could also decelerate it once they were on the ground faster. So it was that kind of that combination that led to a huge impulse in the first portion of the ground contact phase. As far as the negative foot velocity, which I believe you're referring to in the horizontal direction, that kind of came along with the fact that they had a higher, not to get too specific with the terminology, tangential velocity of the foot. It was moving faster both downwards and backwards relative to their center of mass. So it was faster in kind of both directions. So.
That's really interesting. I like the part you said about the decelerating it faster. It's almost, and maybe this, let me know if this is right, but I almost like that in my mind too, the idea of a boxer throwing like a quick, if your right hand's your haymaker hand, your left hand's your jab hand, you want to like whip that hand back very quickly too. And that almost be like decelerating it so that you can not have excessive on the backside, like so the foot can re like come up into position quicker. I'm throwing a lot of thoughts together, so I'm gonna stop before I just completely.
No, those are tremendous thoughts. You're like two steps ahead of the game. That's exactly right. So we use two analogies whenever we had, high level sprinters or coaches in our lab. Of course, we wouldn't go into all these technical terms. We would just basically say, well, you want to cock the hammer and strike the nail, or you want to wind up and punch the ground. So those are the exact two analogies we would use on a regular basis in the lab when we were dealing with athletes. And I mean, when I'm coaching, of course, I don't get into all the technical terms either. I just basically use those two terms. And to your point, yeah, you want to, wind up, throw a stiff punch with what we talk about is like you wouldn't throw a punch with a limp wrist and then press through your fingertips. You would throw a really hard punch by winding up, keeping your wrist stiff and punching with the knuckles on your hands, and then you would immediately, pop back as soon as you deliver that punch, just like you just said. And it's the same concept when striking the ground. You want to wind up, i.e., get that thigh high in front of you, good front side mechanics, aggressive downstroke towards the ground, stiff, quick ground contact, and then abruptly decelerate and pull the limb back off the track. And lastly, to your point, the better you do that and the more force you get down in the first half of ground contact, the less you have to leave the leg on the track behind your center of mass to continue to deliver impulse to the ground. And then that allows you to then immediately pull the leg back up in front of you and have better front side mechanics. So it's this kind of vicious positive or vicious negative cycle. The better you do it one step, the better you're going to be able to do it the next step, so on and so forth. So yeah, that's 100% correct.
Awesome. That's really, yeah, I'm glad that did make sense. Sometimes these things pop into my head, and it's always good to know that they're on the right track. I got two more kind of follow-up questions, and hopefully I can juggle these in my mind long enough to say them correctly. But I'd heard in a sprint technique video, I'd seen Coach Dan Paff talking about how after initial ground strike, like the ankle has to actually yield to allow the center of mass to pass over. Like if you stayed with the ankle too stiff the whole time, you would almost just like pop up. You wouldn't go forward. So is that kind of reflected in the way that you said that it's the first half or was it two third that the ankle is very stiff and then it's less stiff to allow the body to pass over? Does that make sense? I guess I'm trying to tie what I've heard in with what you're saying in your research.
Yeah, really interesting question. I haven't seen that specific video, so I might have a hard time directly tying in my answer to that question. But I'll say this. Generally speaking, we saw, the competitive and more elite sprinters strike on what we term the meaty part of the ball of the foot. They would strike on the track spike, so to speak, with the foot, relatively neutral, the foot and ankle relatively neutral, maybe 3 or 4 degrees. Of positive foot angle, if you will. And then, yeah, as they became weight bearing, as they loaded their body weight on their foot, the heel would come down a little bit. In some runners, the heel would touch the ground as they became weight bearing. In other runners, it would never touch the ground. In some runners, it would on some steps and it wouldn't on others. It was a little bit of step to step variability. From a practical standpoint, to me, it comes to this. I teach the runners that I'm working with, or I coach them, you need to strike on the ball of the foot and you need to strike stiff because you got you know, peak forces, peak vertical forces of 4 to 5 times body weight if you're any good in the first 300ths of a second. You better aim to try to be as stiff as possible or else you're going to crash onto your heel. To me, that's the coaching application of it. So that's probably the best answer I can give you that ties the research into the application.
That's awesome. That's a great clarification of what I was looking for. It actually leads me to the final question of this follow-up question at this point I had for you, and that's, you know, that ankle stiffness you're talking about on the spike plate there. I've heard things like, you know, an athlete is a hip dominant runner or has a lot of ankle stiffness or some combination of these things. But do you find, or what are your thoughts in terms of the, you know, is it a chicken or the egg? Like does having a lot of negative foot speed lead to the adaptation of being stiff in the ankle? Can you have a lot of negative foot speed and still be kind of mushy and need to improve that? How do you think that those two might play together, or is that something we still need to do more research and work on there?
Yeah, probably needs to be a little bit more research done to see how that those two directly tie together. But I'll tell you that in my mind, developing stiffness at the foot ground contact and, you know, at the ankle and all the way up the chain is something that I think every athlete needs, whether they're, you know, an elite sprinter or whether they're a field sport athlete. And we'll probably talk about that later when we get into the differences between, you know, training track athletes versus field sport athletes. But that's something emphasizing all the time with the soccer players that I work with, because they land in a, you know, in a different position because of the way they play the game. You know, I think when it comes to hip dominant versus ankle dominant, I don't know. That's an interesting question, and I'm not sure I know the answer to this. I would say when it comes to hip dominant versus ankle dominant, this is the way I think about it. And you can tell me if this answers the question. During an acceleration, obviously the body's leaning in. The body's at an incline, and the hip is right before ground contact. And during ground contact, the hip is extending mostly concentrically, just because of the ground contact times are longer and the position of the body. It's not as eccentric or reactive as it is when we get to top speed. As we progress through the drives phase and the runner pushes him or herself up, now we get, of course, longer flight times. And now it's a concentric hip action during the last portion of swing phase, but now it has to be really reactive upon ground contact. So I think that always having the ability to get very explosive hip action, hip flexion extension is really important, both in acceleration and in top speed. It's just that the type of muscle action differs. It's highly concentric during early acceleration, and it's much more reactive during ground contact, you know, at top speed. Ankle stiffness and foot ground contact stiffness is going to be important in my mind all the way through the race. So again, I'm not really sure if that answered your question, but that's just kind of the way I think about it.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
No, sure. That's great. Actually, it leads me into some of the other questions, and maybe we can just cover those right away, just because as long as it's kind of on the plate here. So I guess there's a couple that we could get into. The first then is the relationships and similarities between acceleration and top end speed, because you kind of mentioned it's almost like the same kind of mechanics in a way, but the concentric versus eccentric forces, the nature of force. And then this was something you had talked about on the Gamecast as well with Coach Vern Gambetta. So what are some differences and similarities with the mechanics and then the teaching of acceleration and top end speed?
Yeah, I think, you know, clearly the leg cycle action is different between the first three steps of acceleration, where it's much more piston-like, and then once the runner becomes progressively more upright, where the leg action naturally becomes more circular or cyclical. And so clearly that changes between acceleration and top speed. I guess, you know, kind of what I've noticed more and more over the years is that the best athletes have some, you know, unifying actions or unifying strategies, though, from acceleration to through top speed. The posture is really, really strong and neutral from, you know, the head through the shoulders, through the hips, through the stance leg. In other words, they're not folding at the waist. They're not rounding through the thoracic spine. They're tight through the core. So even though during acceleration, the posture is angled forward, and at top speed, they're basically up and down, the power line, if you will, for lack of a better term, that stays consistent. It's just the angle that slightly changes. Maintaining a strategy that's mostly front side dominant, i.e., where the thigh isn't really drifting too far back behind the torso, is a strategy that's pretty consistent from acceleration all the way through top speed. If you read Ralph Mann's book on mechanics of sprinting and hurdling, it's right there in the book that once a sprinter loses their front side mechanics from step one, or step two, that it's hard to regain front side mechanics down the track. And I guess that's an idea that has become more and more apparent to me, is that once an athlete loses their posture or their backside mechanics, it's hard to get back. Aggressive ground contact, stiff ground contact, and this aggressive scissoring of the thighs, I think, remains the same. Again, the angle is different, but really the fact that one is powerfully flexing while the other is powerfully extending doesn't change. So, are there differences between acceleration and top speed? Of course. The ground contact times are longer at acceleration, and the flight times are shorter, and it's vice versa at top speed. The horizontal forces are proportionately larger during acceleration, and of course, the vertical forces are much greater during top speed. So obviously there's these differences, but I tend to see more similarities than differences when I look at the elite runners throughout their initial acceleration through top speed. The last thing I want to throw in here, I picked up this coaching strategy from coaches Bobby Smith and Adam Feit at Ripped Training in Northern New Jersey, and I wanted to give them a mention because it was such an eye-opener for me. They teach maximum velocity mechanics first, and they're some of the few coaches or the first coaches that I'd heard doing this. They teach upright, marching, skipping to teach it at max velocity first, and they don't actually progress back to acceleration until the athlete can do proper posture, front side mechanics, ground contact in an upright position. And I asked them, I visited their facility after I'd heard them speak at a clinic, and I asked them, well, why do you teach it in that order? Most people teach, acceleration first and then max velocity just because that's what happens in the course of a race. And they said, well, if an athlete can't demonstrate proper posture or front side mechanics or ground contact when they're just upright, how the heck are they going to do it at an angle when the demands on the posture are harder? And it made so much sense to me that it started to teach it that way as well. So I thought that was a really interesting point just to kind of finish on.
Wow, that's really cool. I'd never heard that before, but it makes all the sense in the world. I'm glad you brought that up. I think that is also something that maybe Vernon had mentioned on the Gamecast there, where it was like you teaching the top end speed in an upright position does filter down to some of these other movement tiers, and I think it's cool too. I even like Bruce Schechstader, who had been on here, had talked about using top end speed and it actually helped people's vertical jumps, like using it as a warm up. You wonder if there's like these coordinative properties that even filter down into some of these lower angled, these different angled things through that rhythm and timing. I think that's really fascinating.
Yeah, there's a lot of I guess concepts that can transfer just from getting in an upright posture, neutral hips, good thigh flexion, one leg's flexed up in front of you, kind of triple flexion, and the other leg's aggressively pushing down in the ground. Even with the warm-ups that Corey Waltz and I do at Haverford College, we have our athlete get in this three bucket position, bucket of water on the head, resting on the knee, and bucket handle around the foot, and just kind of hold it for balance and stability, but also just to ingrain in them this top speed mechanic. But then if you go to do any acceleration wall piston drill or partner assisted drill or sled march, or push drill, you just say, okay, well, it's just your upright max velocity three bucket position, but now just take that and lean into the wall or lean into the prowler. And it makes it so much easier for the athlete to master that position if they've already mastered it in the upright position versus the way I used to do it, which was try to get them leaning against the wall or the sled or whatever, and have them lean in at an angle and do it. And it just was a mess. And so now it's a lot easier to teach it kind of the other way around for me. So.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. I'll follow up with one more point with the whole similarities, dissimilarities thing that and this is another thing you had mentioned on, I believe it was Mike Robertson's podcast, that I thought was really cool. Like you had mentioned this, I'm like, wow, that makes a lot of sense. I'm going to make sure I start using that myself. And he had mentioned if you had one cue to teach acceleration, I believe, and you had mentioned it was punch. And you always hear people saying push the ground back, which is cool, but you would almost think that that might lead to potentially excessive rear side in some situations. And from what you're talking about, that makes sense with the whole punch thing. Could you explain that a little bit more in detail, what you said on mics, and maybe expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, push your ground away is a great cue. And I think for certain people, that works really well. I have noticed exactly the way you phrase it, though. For certain people, it does lead to, excessive backside mechanics. They might be a little bit more forceful in the first step or two, but it sets them up for failure. Well, it sets them up for suboptimal mechanics, in steps 3, 4, and 5, because they're pushing for maybe a little bit too long, or the thigh starts to trail behind the torso. And so if push isn't working for you in your toolbox, just go to punch, and really it's just the same action in reverse of the other thigh. And so you just emphasize the front side action of the swing leg as opposed to the ground side action of the stance leg. And the harder one leg punches up, the harder the other leg is going to push down reflexively. I mean, that's just the way the body works. Your thighs work like scissors. They have to, or else you'd get rotary torques around your center of mass and you're just running circles all day. And of course that never happens. So the harder your right leg punches up, the harder your left leg punches down or pushes down and back, and so you end up getting more force down and back during acceleration. But for the athletes who this works for, you end up maintaining better front side mechanics. So to me, it's just another good tool to have in the toolbox, where if your athlete still needs a more forceful push, but you want them to do that and keep better front side mechanics, that can be, you can kill two birds with one stone, so to speak. The other way I found that that's a great cue. So Corey Waltz and the speed training he runs for his soccer and lacrosse athletes over there at Haverford College, he does his resisted running not with well primarily not with prowlers or sleds, but just partner resisted runs. So we do partner resisted runs from the front and from behind. And so the really easy cue is, okay, punch your partner in the chest, i.e., drive their knees towards your partner's chest if they're resisting you from the front. And it's a simple cue. It gives them an external target to hit. And what you see is not only great front side mechanics of the swing leg, but you see the ground leg really start to push back hard. So again, it's kind of a win-win cueing situation.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
Yeah, that absolutely sounds like it. I really like that idea of utilizing that cue with the sleds and things like that. Certainly makes it a lot easier. I also like the idea, it's almost like even to teach acceleration, the whole, like, the boom boom sprint drill, or the switching sprint drill. You'd think you could cue that as well too, not only for top end speed, but it might have some context with the acceleration then potentially.
Absolutely. The thigh switch drill, people have a million different names for it, but yeah, the thigh switch drill is one of my favorites as far as, starting and staying in good, three bucket triple flexion, good posture position, rapid front side exchange of the thighs. You have to land in a stiff ground strike position, and the drill is self-limiting, basically, to use a Gray Cook term. You can't have any backside mechanics in that drill, or else you fall on your face. So that's one of my favorites, both for top speed and for acceleration. With some of my individual clients that I train, I'll do that drill as part of our linear speed dynamic warm-up day every single day that we run. That's how much I like that drill.
Yeah, I love it too. I think it's awesome. So the second part of what I think I had the two follow-up questions, and that was one, and then, well, or the second, sorry, the second question I was going to cut in line, because we had talked about it a little bit, was kind of classifying athletes. I think there's a big push out there. Our athletes anterior chain or posterior chain dominant? Are we force, or some of the things that JB Marin is now talking about, force versus velocity? And then we already covered the idea of ankle and hip and those types of things. Do you think, what's the simplest way to approach all this in terms of if I'm going to try to correct a deficiency or play to an athlete's strengths over time? Do you have some thoughts in that whole arena?
Great question, and I'm not sure I know the answer yet. I think that to me, that's one of the most intriguing areas that's becoming popular right now, and I'm really excited, I guess, to get a better grip on this myself, both as a researcher, but I guess more importantly as a coach. To me, I've become increasingly interested. I use a free lap, that's my timing system when I'm doing linear speed work, and analyzing the split times. I also have a radar gun, so I've been doing some of that velocity profiling as well. So yeah, I think there are ways where that can be very beneficial as far as highlighting an athlete's relative strengths versus weaknesses. I think, there's also ways just to bucket an athlete or classify an athlete and say, okay, what's this athlete's build, i.e., are they tall and lean? Are they short and stocky? What's their relative strength, either from weight room numbers or more importantly, just from simple field tests, like, are they explosive? Are they powerful in a broad jump and a vertical jump? And are their acceleration splits matching up to where they should be from their anthropometrics and their simple power tests? And are their top speed splits matching up to that as well? So this is far from an inexact science, what I'm talking about, but I guess on with some more of my private clients, where I've been going with this is just developing some buckets for where athletes should be relative to what their physical metrics are, both from an anthropometrics and a strength power standpoint. And I think it's Dan John who has some, gaps and standards or gaps, standards and thresholds, something like that, for all the athletes he works to. And I think for me, it will ultimately be developing, okay, let's come up with some gap standards and thresholds. If I have an athlete who's this big, they weigh, they're this tall, they weigh this much, and they are this strong relative to their body mass, can they hit certain thresholds or standards for the relative linear speed marks? I think that's where I'm interested in seeing it go. Probably not the most scientific answer in the world, but that's, I guess, where the next step is for me.
Sure. No, that's a great way of looking at it as well. So basically just using like split times and what's the top end relative to acceleration or various ideas like that to using that as a quantification tool.
Yeah, and again, I'm using both at the moment, both split times. When I have athletes run 40 or 50 yard dashes, getting every 10 yards, or same thing for 60 meter dash, and simultaneously with the radar gun. But yeah, trying to do velocity profiling to figure out where they're relatively strong, relatively weak, and does it match up to what their body type and proportionate strength metrics are as well. In other words, is it a technique error if they are relatively weaker in acceleration versus top speed? Is it because they're just physically lacking and it's something we need to address with our strength and power development and in the weight room or plyometrics? Or is it something where they should be able to, i.e., accelerate well if it's a, let's say it's a relatively shorter, stockier guy, but he's incredibly strong and powerful relative to his body mass, but he's still not a guy who's great acceleration? Then maybe we need to identify him as something that's, relatively, where there's maybe a technique error. So maybe just ways to gain insight as to classifying, bucketing athletes, and then once we've done that, okay, does that give us insight as to whether or not it's more of a, strength power issue, or whether or not it's a pure technique issue?
Yeah, those, I mean, just using those metrics, I think is awesome. It kind of reminds me a little bit what you were saying there of something Curtis Taylor had mentioned back at least 10 episodes here on the podcast of using trochanter length and how long should your strides optimally be, and then kind of starting from there and using that kind of as a qualitative beacon as well, as opposed to, yeah, like kind of what I was saying, like the it's almost more idealistic in a way, looking at all these hip and ankle and anterior posterior and yeah, just look at quantitative numbers and splits and stride lengths, I think gives us so much.
Yeah, the other thing I will add, just to kind of come back to the two mass model and some of the algorithms that have come out of the SMU lab, we now have ways of calculating vertical forces during top speed sprinting, both average and peak forces for any athlete at any speed, just from video. So it's not quite ready for the masses yet, but that's one thing, of course, I'm going to be heavily interested in is using that to dive in just a little bit deeper than the split times or even just the velocity profiles from the radar, and saying, okay, are there ways that we can potentially affect this athlete's force signature to help them run faster? So
That's awesome. So you're gonna be able to just take a video, like with no kinetic data, and be able to predict the
that's what the
forces.
algorithm allows for. Yeah, so that's I don't want to overstate how ready that is yet. It's not ready for the masses yet, but yes, there's certainly that possibility.
That's a, that that sounds like it's gonna be awesome though. Very, very cool. So with all this sprint mechanic type things we've been talking about so far, Are there any, I think a common question would be, what sprint drills do you recommend? I'm going to maybe take it the other way. And do you think there's any common sprint drills or approach to drills itself, or way, things that coaches cue that are counterproductive that you've seen that you don't really agree with?
I guess I'll say two, and again, these are just what hasn't worked for me. So it could have just been the way I employed them. It doesn't necessarily mean they're bad drills, and I'm sure there's some great coaches in the listening audience who might use this drill or use this cue and disagree. But so I used to use kind of the wall cycle drill just as a precursor for kind of step overs, and I still think step overs can be a good warm up, sprint drill. I've totally gone away from kind of the wall cycle drill and anything that enforces, a really circular action, at least unless it's part of something that's for dynamic warm up. And a reason for that is as follows. Again, in my head, what I've seen from the better competitive sprinters is, yes, the leg action naturally goes from more piston-like to more cyclical during the course of the sprint as they go from acceleration to top speed. But about 2 or 3 years ago, I came to the conclusion that it's not anything remotely conscious. That's just the way it happens due to the way that the body posture changes and the leg whipping action occurs. So it just goes from piston and in steps one, two, and three to cyclical. And you don't really need to cue that part of it or drill that part of it. And anything I had done in a best case scenario, I found had no transfer at all. Like it wasn't hurting anything, but it wasn't helping anything. It was just, 5 minutes of time perhaps I could have spent better in other places. And in a worst case scenario, it was making my athlete overthink, which of course is not a good thing. So again, maybe that was just the way I was using it, and I'll be the first to admit I'm not the best coach out there. So maybe I wasn't using the drill correctly, but that's absolutely one thing I've gone away from. And I've gone away from, at least to a certain extent, some of the step over drills as well. I do think they have value just kind of in getting the athlete to react, on and off the ground. I do see value in some of the dribble drills and some of those sort of things as it relates to posture and ground contact. But as far as just pure wall drills and that sort of thing, I've gotten away from it. And replaced it with more. This might have been one of your other questions. More like the thigh switch drills. Again, whatever you want to call those. I love the straight leg shuffle, straight leg run, straight leg bound type of drills. To me, for top speed, that really enforces stiff ground contact, strike under your center of mass, stay upright posture, and it minimizes or eliminates any backside mechanics. You just can't have it. The drill doesn't allow for it, even if it's done only moderately well. So I've replaced most cyclical drills with kind of the thigh switch or the straight leg front side type of drills. So that's for top speed. For acceleration, I've really gone away from any type of cue about, projecting out low or running low or keeping the torso low. And this is something that's fascinating. Again, I mentioned that at Westchester University, we have great coaches, Jason Kilgore and Nate Kennedy, who's particularly who I hang out with down on the track as they work with their sprinters and hurdlers and multis. And they, really do a great job of cueing, hey, just apply force and push yourself up, in a gradual progression of angles throughout the course of the drive phase. And, I think a lot of athletes perhaps have gotten into bad habits about trying to just run low at the start, and what that leads to is, of course, just flexion at the trunk. They're not really pushing back hard at all. They're just kind of bending over low, but they're not really driving themselves up and out. So that's one thing I've really gotten away from that perhaps I think, is good to follow suit for other coaches who've maybe cued it the other way in the past. And I know I had in the past. That's just kind of a mistake I made. So
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
That's great. I like how you started that all off with, like the context of it all. Maybe in a situation this cue could be good, but yeah, that's not the first time I've heard that about the wall drills and things like that. And I like how you gravitated towards those. Yeah, like as you say, self-limiting drills. Like it's dynamic and self-limiting, and it kind of reduces the potential negatives that could come out of it. To continue on too with you'd started to talk about cues and acceleration. Is there any cues that you would avoid in terms of teaching top end speed?
Boy, that's a great question. As far as teaching top end speed, I can't think of any that I've really gotten away from entirely. And the reason I say that is this. I don't generally teach the step over strike down cue anymore, kind of in concert with what I just said about not doing the wall step over drill as much. I rarely use that cue. So I still will in an occasion there's like an athlete every now and then who just cycles really, really low. And you just kind of do need to say, all right, well, you just need to step over as if there's a mini hurdle, at your other knee, and that fixes things. So I don't want to say I don't use it at all. Every once in a while, you need a lot of different tools in your toolbox because different athletes have different errors. So I will still use that every once in a while. I've gone away from that. So I use that cue a lot less, the step over strike down. Much more so it's either smash forward or punch up or just hammer down or punch the ground. Again, to steal a cue from Coach Kilgore Kennedy at Westchester, they teach top speed sprinting like almost sprint like you march. They teach that for both acceleration and top speed, which I just absolutely love just because of the imagery it puts in the athlete's head. I mean, I think we all know like an A march, what those angles, positions, and forces look like. And so that's I guess I've gravitated more towards those type of cues as opposed to away from any one singular cue. But if I've gone away from something, I probably do less of the step over strike down cue than I used to. So.
Cool. I like how with the march, the sprint here, you march. It makes it really easy to draw context there too for, warm ups then going into practice.
Absolutely, yeah, and I think that's kind of the major idea. Yeah, as the athletes get it in their head, and it makes it easier. Yeah, it makes it easier to coach, on the fly, whether it's acceleration or top speed. So.
Awesome. So moving there, just trying to get through some more of these in the back end. There's actually one question I really want to make sure I get it got to you here.
Sure.
They're excited for your opinion and thoughts on it. But first, kind of more towards the back end, thoughts on resisted or maybe specifically assisted sprinting, because I think I've heard you mention kind of the future of where sprint training is headed, especially with like things like the 1080 and these fine tuning overspeed tools. What are your thoughts on those two modalities in teaching sprint speed?
Yeah, absolutely. I've said it before. I am a fan of resisted sprint training for acceleration. I think most of the recent research is saying that it's at least as effective as unresisted training, if not more effective. To me, it makes perfect sense. To accelerate effectively, you need to push as hard down and back relative to your body mass as possible. If we can, load a runner up either with a pull sled or a push sled to do that, to me that makes sense. Acceleration is a push punch, and we need to put our athletes in positions and modalities to do that. There's going to be more research coming out on exactly what resistances, what loads are appropriate. It'll probably be population dependent, and I'm excited to see kind of what some of that research demonstrates. Yeah, as far as the top speed training goes, to me that's going to be the most interesting because I think that's where the least research has been done. I think there's only a few peer-reviewed publications, if that, like two or three that I know of, that have looked at overspeed and in particular longitudinal training studies on overspeed. And to me, the bugaboo with it was always that you couldn't dial in exact overspeed values. Sorry, I mean, when I did it as a kid, my dad was pulling me with the big old bungee cord, and then I did it for 2 years as a grad assistant college coach, and then got away from it because we had a few hamstring strains, and I never wanted to do it again. But with the 1080 or with similar devices, I think it's going to open up a new world of not only dialing in exactly the specific overspeed, but the specific velocity profiles throughout the course of a sprint. And to me, I think the reason why there's so much potential there is because top speed is so highly neural. I mean, I realize I'm not, shedding and breaking any new ground by saying that, but it you have to have such a high drive from the nervous system to be able to put that much force down into the ground in that short of ground contact time. And that I think that potentially mechanisms like the 1080 are going to be able to elicit that type of drive that we really can't get in any other situation. So have some collaborations coming up with some mutual friends of ours, and I'm excited to see where that goes as far as like using the 1080 and seeing how that affects top speed sprinting both acutely and longitudinally. So.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm excited to see where that leads as well. Using that controlled overspeed has just been a really cool experience for mine for the few weeks I was able to. The next question, this is kind of a, I'm not sure if this is a kind of a nerding out question or hair splitting, or maybe a comment, maybe on my end, a combination of both. But I've heard Franz Bosch mention the idea of sprinting almost being built around the attractor length of the hamstrings, or basically when the foot is accelerating down to the ground, the angle in that leg or the amount of bend in that leg being a function of what the hamstring can either handle or what it's programmed to do. And so, we're a very where some sprinters might run with lower hips and that leg has more bend, or a very elastic person might run with straight legs, straighter legs. I ask this too, this is almost a selfish question on mine, because I run with extremely straight legs, like I'm triple jumping almost. And I always wondered
Right.
why is that? So anyways, just kind of thoughts, I guess more or less of what I'm really asking is, what are your thoughts on the amount of bend in the knee when that foot is being swept towards the ground, towards strike? Is that something that we should look at? Coach, is that a coaching factor? Is it something we can look at as far as hamstring strength or the weight room? Any thoughts in that realm?
Yeah. In my opinion, this is just pure speculation. But in my opinion, I don't think that there's going to be one optimal length or angle across a range of runners. I do think it's going to be highly individualized as far as the amount of bend in the leg as it approaches ground contact and then as it strikes the ground. But I've always loved Franz's concept of the whip from the hip, and that's really to get nerdy concepts here, it's that kind of that angular momentum which is generating the straightening of the leg during the downstroke of the entire swing leg. And frankly, to tie it into some of the things that we looked at with a two-mass model, it's that whip from the hip which is then generating a higher velocity of the lower limb as it attacks the ground and ultimately connected with a stiff ground contact generates larger ground reaction forces as well. So it's all tied together. So I don't know that there's an optimal length, hamstring length, knee angle, that sort of thing. I think it's going to be pretty individualized. But from a coaching standpoint, to me, we are absolutely trying to improve our athletes' front side mechanics, i.e., limit their backside mechanics, improve their front side mechanics, get the thigh in a higher position above the ground later in the swing phase. If you read Ralph Mann's Mechanics of Sprinting and Hurdling, he touches on this. So you want that thigh higher in the air, longer into flight, so that it can now really whip from the hip, to use Franz's term. And what that's going to do is through angular momentum cast that leg out and down and back into the track. From a coaching standpoint, I want to see that whip from the hip increase over time. So whatever I'm doing with my athlete, I want to see that athlete get in a better position over time with the thigh higher above the ground later in swing and then aggressively downstroke with a higher rotary velocity, which could potentially lead to a straighter leg. That's pure speculation that over time, if this was all being done better, that it would lead to potentially less bend in the knee as the athlete approached the ground. But I don't know. That's just kind of my train of thought right now.
No, I don't mind speculation at all. I mean, probably 99% of my thought processes revolves around speculation, thinking the things like that. I like how you brought it into the mechanical concepts there, like the almost the tangential velocity of that lower limb and how the mechanical nature of how that's accelerated almost outside of the muscle properties itself.
Absolutely. You know, with running, it's so funny. Of course, it's one step leads into the next, and because you have, you know, what one thigh is doing as it retracts and approaches the ground, the other thigh is doing as it flexes up in front of you. So you, in my mind, you have to evaluate these things in a cyclical nature, because what you're doing right now as you approach ground contact is going to directly affect your flight mechanics for the next, you know, the next phase and your next step. So it's the best way to think about things in my mind.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, looking at how not just one leg or one joint, but what's the other side doing?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's been one of the big kind of breakthroughs for me in the last year, and thinking of some things related to sprinting. I have one last question for you, Ken.
Sure.
And that is, and obviously this could be a huge one, but basically, so the stuff we've mentioned for in terms of sprinting, how do we look at this in terms of team and field sports? Are there going to be, well, first off, are there going to be a lot of or any key differences in the way these athletes are moving around in the field, both in acceleration or their top end speed, which obviously their top end speed, the way they approach that's a little bit different than a, you know, Usain Bolt or a track sprinter?
Yeah, this is probably my favorite question the entire interview. I love this because I'm kind of knee deep in this right now. So as I mentioned, with my buddy Corey Waltz, who's the head strength coach over at Haverford College, we're right in the middle of training their fall sport athletes, you know, in their off season. So we're doing men's soccer team we have a 6-week training program, and we train them twice a week, and one day a week is more linear speed based. So this past year we kind of we evaluated and then evolved our linear speed training program for our field sport athletes, and just decided, okay, what do we need to do to make this more competitive, more reactive for our athletes? It had been a great program in the past. The drills were excellent, but it was a little bit more closed and non-reactive and non-competitive. And we set out with the goal of trying to still do things technically correct and have opportunities to install correct technique, but also to make it much more game-like in terms of the situations that they're going to be accelerating, reacting to an opponent, that sort of thing. So what we ended up coming up with, and the fall semester was the first semester we did it. This is now the second semester this spring that we've been doing it, was we warm them up. We follow kind of Ian Jeffries' ramp dynamic warm-up program, and then we get into kind of a compete technique, compete, whole part, whole type of process. So we start with a competitive type of drill. So it is something like a, you know, a tag game, a linear or lateral mirror drill, even just partner races where one guy is just, you know, it's partner A and partner B, and partner A is just going at his own initiative, and partner B just has to react as soon as partner A goes, and they're just doing like a 20-yard race, that sort of thing. So we start with something that's designed to get them engaged, get them competing. We want them going at full speed. We think that's the best way to get these field sport athletes faster. After that, we'll take what the athletes were demonstrating in the compete section, and we'll work on it in a technique-based section. So during the first compete section, we're not doing that much overt coaching. We're basically setting up the drill. We're letting the athletes compete and go full speed. And we're doing a lot of observing, just kind of what are the main errors that we're seeing being made. So for acceleration, are they too short and choppy with their steps? Are they spinning their wheels and not getting anywhere? Are they leaning over at the waist and not keeping a strong posture? If it's a longer type of competitive drill, you know, are they running with bad backside mechanics and bad hip position, that sort of thing. So we'll try to take our observations, and then we have a middle section, which we call technical, and all we're doing is now it's closed drills where we are going through, you know, maybe it's something as simple as a march, a skip. Maybe it's our partner resisted drills where we're working on acceleration, you know, push punch type of things. For top speed, we do what are called technical buildups. They're essentially 60-yard flies, 20-yard buildup, 20 yards at full speed, 20-yard decel. And in that middle zone, they're working on one technical cue each time, posture, arm drive, or front side mechanics, or ground contact phase. So we have a number of different things that we're working on for either acceleration or top speed in that technical section. And then we go to what we call compete two, where now it's a more progressed version of that first compete drill. it's still competitive, it's open, it's reactive, and we're hoping at least to see some improvement on the mistakes that we saw in the earlier compete. It's not quite to that point where we're always seeing a direct transfer and improvement in that second section from the first, but that's at least the idea. As I said, kind of this whole part whole type of motor learning concept to it, and also it gives us a chance to put them in more of a game situation. So we don't do too much where they start from a pure 2-point or 3-point or 4-point static start, and they just do a 20-yard dash or a 40-yard dash from that, because that's not practical to a soccer player or a lacrosse player. That's not the way their game is played. So almost all of our drills are done either reacting to another person or from some sort of moving type of start. So I don't know if that answered your question, but that's the way we've been approaching it this year. And we're really happy with it so far. We've gotten good feedback from the athletes. We feel like it's given us a good chance to both put them in competitive positions and also make beneficial technical changes. And it's gotten them really engaged in the process.
That's awesome. No, it definitely answered that. Well, I like the idea of the compete technique, compete, especially too with a group that probably, athletes love to compete, and they probably to be able to enter practice and be able to kind of move naturally, I'm sure is, and then get into the technical elements, I'm sure is enjoyable for a lot of people. And as well as just observing how athletes move, like with no coaching at all before you start getting into that.
Yeah. And it helps us, basically relate it to the athletes as to why this is important. And we do a similar concept with our multidirectional speed, which is the other day per week. But I know that, you know, sometimes with athletes, if you're just doing like an A march or like, you know, any other type of drill and there's no context to it, it might be a great drill, but if they can't relate it to why it's important to them on the field, they're just not going to buy in as much. They're just not going to engage or go as hard. So it's given us a great way in compete one, even though we're not really coaching the technique that much, we just say, okay, this is a situation that's similar to what you guys do on the field. This is the drill. And then in technique, we say, okay, well, this is why it's important to be good at that, and this is how we're going to fix it. And then we fix it up in technical. So it's allowed for, I think, better engagement.
Sure. Yeah. So I two kind of last follow-up questions then on that. The first was, you had mentioned in teaching acceleration, do you typically, whereas like in track speed, you would want to be a little bit longer through your first strides to build momentum, or so is the thought. How do you approach that acceleration? And obviously it's not from a track position, so I guess it changes things a little bit, like you mentioned, but how do you approach that with the team sport athletes, and how long those initial strides should be in terms of making a play of like 5 yards, 10 yards,
yeah,
20 yards?
Yeah. Tremendous question. I think I'm still working on that answer in my own head. In my mind, it's this. So obviously in a game situation, we don't want them to be super long and patient, because, you know, that might not be the optimal way to get to the ball. Or frankly, just in the context of avoiding opponents and getting the ball, that might not be possible given whatever constraints they're dealing with. But I do think that field sport athletes in general, a common mistake they make is to spin the wheels too fast and not cover any ground. So to me, it's a great thing to coach in a technical aspect of practice. I'm not saying that we're going to, you know, coach a really specific drive phase the same way they're running a 40-yard dash or a 100-meter dash, but just to coach the general concepts of, okay, apply force, push punch, that sort of thing. And then clearly in a game situation, if the situation calls for them to be shorter or choppier to get to the ball, they might naturally revert to it at that point. But anything we can do in a practice situation to get them to apply more force in the right direction with a stiff ground contact will ultimately put them at an advantage in a game situation. So that's how I view that question. But yeah, to your point, it is definitely, you know, it's different acceleration patterns for a soccer athlete who needs to get to a ball that's 7 yards away versus on the pitch versus, you know, a 100-meter sprinter who needs to have a prolonged drive phase. So
yeah, no, I like how you answered that. It actually kind of made me think a little bit about kind of what's in the Franz Boas strength and coordination book. Like, you're exposing athletes to all these different motor patterns, and their nervous system will select or almost like troubleshoot as they go. And you'd also mentioned too, like, I think you'd mentioned that team sport athletes have that excess, are prone to those excessive backside mechanics. And
yeah,
so just teach them. It's like they can always put it in their library for use. It at least that's the way I kind of see that from what you've said there.
No, 100%. You know, so I've been on record, you know, I do really like teaching top speed mechanics for field sport athletes, you know, even though for certain sports, they're rarely getting into those true top speed mechanics. But my thinking is always this: it's great neural training, if nothing else, because, you know, it's the most force in the least amount of time you can get from any drill. I think it's great postural training. So getting into, you know, the proper postures, whether it's top speed or acceleration, is key. And yes, to your point, field sport athletes, you know, most of the time they're running with kind of the torso somewhat flexed and the hips, you know, and slightly anterior tilt, i.e., you know, belt buckle down, and they're running maybe sometimes plantar flexed, especially the soccer players. They're on their toes to kick a ball and with excessive backside swing. Stuff that's great for their sport and being able to, you know, stop and start and change direction on a dime, but it's not necessarily ideal mechanics for those few instances in a game when they do really need to break into a top speed sprint. And again, I'm biased when it comes to this, but, you know, when those plays happen, you better be able to do it. And because those are a lot of times a game breaking plays.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to me to, or important for us rather, to be able to teach the athletes, okay, well, you might be in this situation when you're accelerating or changing directions, but when it's time to go, you know, got to be able to get the hips underneath you, get your posture upright, get the front side mechanics and strike stiff, that sort of thing.
So. Yeah, I love that explanation. That answers it really well. Cool. So last question here, and you had mentioned a little bit of mirror drills. What are some, breaking it down maybe into a little bit of nuts and bolts, like what's an example of some of the mirror drills or maybe cat and mouse or reactive drills that you really like for a team sport with a lateral and reactive component?
Yeah, so for our multi-directional speed, we've developed the 6-week progression. So first we start with linear acceleration and deceleration. So even though it's multi-directional speed, our week one, day one, is still only moving forwards and stopping, basically. We figure that's the most important thing from a safety standpoint. So we'll do linear mirror drills, i.e. offense, defense, with one guy playing the trail technique. The defense is playing the trail technique and the offensive guy is, you know, 3 yards in front and kind of either jogs or sprints or stops at his own initiative. And the defender has to kind of, you know, accelerate or decelerate and stop to mirror the offensive player. So that's kind of week one. Week two and week three, we get into similar concepts. Some of your kind of more classic mirror drills, but now we're moving in either, you know, side to side, front to back, or on an angle. So we do what's kind of what's called the Y attack drill, where the person on offense will come in, make a move, and then cut at a 45 degree angle. And the person on defense has to open their hips and go, because that's a pretty common, you know, occurrence in almost any of your field and court sports that you're looking at, whether it's soccer, lacrosse, basketball, football, you name it. So we progress to those type of drills. In week 4 and 5, we get into more complex versions of that. So we kind of get into offense, defense, but now in a 10 to 20 yard area. So where the defender has kind of this more open approach. So they kind of approach from a 5 to 10 yard area, try to close down the space on the offensive person. And the offensive person has either 10 to 20 yards, you know, front to back, side to side, and it's basically one move and go. And it's kind of two-hand touch type of deal, if you will. And we are coaching that up in the technical aspect of it. So it follows the same compete one, technical, compete two. And so we don't really coach much in the compete one, but compete two, we're teaching the defender how to close down space, and we're teaching the offensive player how to attack the defender and stick the foot in the ground and go. And then weeks 5 and 6, we get into much more curve running, because I think that's a really underappreciated aspect of field and court sports. And frankly, if you look at a lot of developmental athletes, whether it's high school kids or even Division III, Division II athletes, they don't know how to run a curve. It gets pretty ugly. They stand upright. They don't know what to do with their arms. They're not leaning in. And they're not nearly as fast on a curve as they should be. And if you look at coming off a screen in basketball or a set play in soccer, a lot of times if you're off the ball and you're trying to create separation from a defender, curve running is a really huge component of it. And likewise, if you are the defender, being able to stay with them is a huge component of it. And we feel that's really under-addressed, or it had been under-addressed in our prior speed and agility progression. So we progress to that in weeks 5 and 6 because we feel like that's one of the most That's one of the most difficult things to do. Some of our simple drills. We'll play duck, duck, deuce, duck, duck, goose as our compete, which ends up being this really interesting constraints-based type of curve running type of deal, and the athletes get really into it. We'll do technical drills where we're curve running around the three-point line or the center court on the basketball court, and then we'll do kind of similar mirror drills around the three-point line. So things like that. So you get in some pretty neat constraint-based type of drills towards the end of the progressions. So.
That's awesome. I love it. I love the idea of training starts with the children's game of duck, duck, goose, learning to run a curve. If you didn't do it, you're gonna be messed up later because you didn't learn how to run a curve when you were five. So
Exactly. So.
that's awesome, man. Well, hey, that's all the time we had today, Ken. But thanks so much for all your answers and your time here. That was awesome. Loved all those speed concepts. I'm gonna start putting a lot of them to use myself, and so much great thought, food for thought too. So thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
All right, that does it for another episode. Thank you so much for tuning in with us today for the Just Fly Performance Podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard, please don't hesitate to leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever your listening platform of choice might be. Also, please visit our sponsors, simplyfaster.com, suppliers of high-end training technology such as the K-Box, GymAware, 1080 Sprint, RunScribe, and more. They also have an amazing blog with tons of great information on speed training, track and field, technology and monitoring, athletic performance, and more. We'll be back next week with Coach Ron McKee-Free, author of CEO Strength Coach. You guys are going to love it. We'll see you guys then.